Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The United States spends far more than any other country on the military. Last week, President Obama signed a $633 billion military spending bill with little to no debate. It includes $527 billion for the base Pentagon budget, $88 billion for Iraq and Afghanistan, $17 billion for national security programs in the Energy Department, and it authorizes $10 billion for missile defense, including funds for a Pentagon feasibility study on three possible missile defense sites on the East Coast. According to the website militaryindustrialcomplex.com, last month alone, there were 335 publicly reported defense contracts totaling $43 billion. That's in 1 month alone. When you factor in homeland security, retirement, and other health care costs for the military, you're talking about $1 trillion a year. And again, even though there is a raging debate about the so-called entitlements and the deficit, there's little to no debate about the military budget in the media. Why is this? On today's Your Call, we are talking about what's in the military budget. How have priorities changed under President Obama? And what will it take to have a real debate about this budget? Joining us to talk about this is Chris Hellman. He's senior research analyst at the National Priorities Project, where he focuses on military spending, bases, and major Pentagon weapons systems. Chris has previously held similar positions at the Center for Arms Control and Nonproliferation, and the Center for Defense Information. He's also a former Capitol Hill staffer, so he knows what goes on behind the scenes. And he joins us from Washington. Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the show. Oh, we're going to be joined by Chris in just a couple minutes. We are joined by Bill Hartung. He's Director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy and author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military Industrial Complex. And he writes extensively about these issues. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, first off, what explains the lack of debate about the military budget at a time when we're having a raging debate about things like Social Security and Medicare?
Well, you know, a lot of us have been trying to elevate it in the debate. I think, you know, partly the fight in the last round was over taxes and, Democrats wanting to raise revenues in some way. And then Republicans wanted to slash entitlement. So Pentagon got caught in the middle of that, and I think that was part of it. I think obviously you've got a lot of hawks on both sides of the aisle who don't want to cut it, therefore don't want to talk about it. And you've got some liberals who have military facilities or contractors in their states and districts who also are a lot quieter than you might expect in terms of going after the Pentagon.
Any in California?
Any
quiet liberals?
Oh, quiet liberals.
Yeah.
Well, it really depends on the, it almost goes system by system. And I think, you know, the senators, for example, when they tried to get rid of the F-22 combat aircraft, which has a lot of California presence, were not game to do that, even though they've been better across the board on these issues. So, it sort of comes down to if it's in your state, if it's in your district, it's more the exception than the rule that somebody would vote against that particular program. So that's part of what clocks things up in terms of trying to get this issue resolved in what I would think would be more constructive direction.
Right, and often the argument is that you can't cut these systems because people will lose jobs, and you've written extensively about this, and we'll talk about that throughout the show. And I believe we now have Chris Hellman on the line. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Sorry about that.
You.
Yeah, nice to have you. Sorry we cut you off there accidentally.
Not a problem.
So what are your thoughts about why there's a lack of debate on the military spending bill? Again, $633 billion signed last week by the president. When you total in everything else, you're talking about, what is it, about $1 trillion a year?
Yeah. When you cast your net more broadly, and you include war and veterans and things of that type, it gets very quickly up into sort of the $1 trillion range. But on this particular bill, what struck me as we watched it was, for instance, in the Senate, the vote was 98-0 in support of this legislation. And this is in a Washington that's so divided right now. They waited until the absolute last hour to pull us back from the edge of the fiscal cliff. And yet, when it comes to defense spending, there's this you know, this level of unanimity it's shocking. To my mind, you know, how can you be a U.S. senator and find that every provision in this bill is so perfect that no one is going to vote against it?
98-0. So yeah. two people did not vote.
Yeah. And I'm not, I think they were in the hospital.
So was there any debate at all on this bill?
There's always debate, but one of the things that we've seen in recent years is, and Bill was alluding to this earlier, is this sort of increasing lack of courage when it comes to questioning things on national security. And this is always true during wartime, where as an elected official you don't want to be perceived as being, not supportive of our troops. But I think in a lot of ways that's a fig leaf, and that's something people say when what they really want to do is vote for higher defense budgets for whatever reasons. And as you pointed out, a lot of that has to do with jobs, particularly in a tough economy.
So what really strikes you about this bill? I mean, even reading the AP, Agence France-Presse, the New York Times, it was hard to really get a grasp of what's in it. What the media did tell you is that basically they broke it down in maybe five sentences. $527 billion for the base Pentagon budget, $88.5 billion for overseas operations, including Afghanistan and Iraq. This one got me because I don't hear much about this. $10 billion for a possible missile defense site. We're talking three sites on the East Coast. But that's just about everything you got in media reports. What can you tell us about what's actually in this $633 billion military bill, Chris?
Well, as you point out, the important one of the important components of it is the $88 billion in change for military operations, primarily in Afghanistan. There's a little bit of residual money for Iraq, but it's in the sort of $2 to $3 billion range. And then there's $80-90 billion in weapons procurement, which includes in part that $10 billion you spoke about in missile defense. There's funding for personnel. The military, in addition to feeding and clothing and housing their personnel, they also provide them health insurance. That's a growing edge within the defense budget, just like it is in everybody else's sort of household budget, which is how much you're going to pay for health care. So this is everything that the Pentagon does. What's intriguing, and Bill can speak to this as well, is the cost of doing these things has grown. If you take out the cost of war, the cost of doing these things has grown significantly over the last decade. And one has to wonder, why is it that we're seeing increases in defense spending absent war costs in the sort of 50% range over the last decade? I think that's a question where we really need to focus our attention. Not why is it we can't cut it. Why is it going up?
Well, why is it going up, Bill? How do you explain that?
Well, I think there's a number of factors. One is, I think, the fact that we've been at war gives an edge to hawks who want to say, we got to spend what we need to spend, even if the money they're talking about is not being devoted to the conflicts, because they have a separate, a contingency fund to pay for that stuff. So I think part of it is the environment allows to make some simplistic arguments about, more is better in terms of the Pentagon. I think part of it is when the money's there, a lot of money gets wasted. There was a discussion about the F-35 fighter plane, which is built by Lockheed Martin. Senator McCain described their management of the program as abysmal. Mm-hmm. And when one of the procurement officials at the Pentagon was asked, well, how does this happen? He said, well, when there's money around, you reach for money. I mean, you've got to solve a problem. There's more money. You just go for it. So I think it's almost feeds on itself. Once the money's pumping in, the need to be disciplined about how you spend it sort of goes out the window.
Well, and we'll talk about the F-35 because that one tends to get a lot of, some scrutiny. For example, Foreign Policy Magazine had a great piece about the F-35. But before we do that, what about priorities? How have things really changed under the Obama administration, if at all, when it comes to military spending, Bill?
Well, there has been a change. There's talk about, there's a 10-year projection that's $487 billion less than would have been the case, if the Pentagon got what it wanted. That's built into law now, so it's not just the president, Congress signed off on it. But basically what that means is things have leveled off. A few years ago we were at the highest level since World War II. it would, if the Pentagon and the contractors had their way, it would have gone up and up forever. And so, you know, some fiscal realities came into play, and now it's leveled off at still very high levels historically. So it's not, you know, it's not like tomorrow we're going to spend 10% less than we have today. Although, if we get sequestered, you know, that'll be an interesting, you know, development in terms of that. But at the moment, we haven't seen any significant cuts. We've just kind of leveled off at a high plateau.
Have you seen any changes, though, in terms of the weapons systems that are being bought, the contracts that are given out, a priority for, you know, Lockheed over Boeing, for example? I mean, is there anything, any changes in that area?
Well, Chris has got, you know, I think may have a better blow-by-blow analysis of that, but certainly you have things like drones, which were modest factors, you know, 10 years ago, which have become central to the waging of warfare. But part of the problem is they haven't given up that much. I mean, in the Air Force, for example, they'd like to build a new bomber. They're building the F-35. They want to build a new tanker aircraft. And so, you know, even under current levels of projected spending, they're not going to be able to do all that. And likewise, you know, the Navy would be hard-pressed to build a new ballistic missile submarine and more aircraft carriers and new generations of other kinds of combat ships. So it's sort of like doing an archaeological dig when you go to the Pentagon. There's like the Cold War weapons, there's the most recent weapons, there's the weapons for the future. But, you know, with some notable exceptions, a lot of times they don't get rid of stuff. They just sort of build on top of it.
Mm. Chris, what changes have you seen under the Obama administration?
Well, I just want to echo what Bill said, is that while you have seen increasing area, you know, new investment in certain areas, and I'll come back to that, what you haven't seen is them giving up on a lot of stuff. And in part, that has to do with congressional mandates. For instance, every year the Pentagon sends a shopping list of aging aircraft that they would love to see retired. Some are transports, some are fighter aircraft and stuff like that. And inevitably the Pentagon hears the same message from Congress, which is, yeah, not this year. And that's because, you know, no members of Congress want to see aircraft in their districts retired. Where you are seeing increasing areas of investment, one is to support the strategic pivot, is what they refer to it, of it's basically refocusing our attention away from our traditional interests in Europe towards our growing interests in the Pacific region. So you're seeing a shifting of men, women, and material into that region, and the creation of an infrastructure to support that. Likewise, you're seeing a much greater emphasis, although these are small numbers compared to, you know, the things that they're already doing, but you're seeing a growing level of interest in our special operations forces. And the other really sort of new area investment and interest of the military is what they refer to as cyber warfare, attacking the electronic infrastructure of our potential foes and protecting our own infrastructure from potential attacks, which I think the military is increasingly viewing as sort of its Achilles heel on the battlefield. One of the things that makes our military so superior to other forces when they go into combat is our ability to dominate the electronic spectrum, and there are real concerns that countries like China and Iran and some others, even smaller ones, are looking at ways to poke holes into that. So that's an area of increasing interest over the last few years.
That is Chris Hellman, Senior Research Analyst at National Priorities Project, where he focuses on military spending, bases, and major weapons systems. Bill Hartung is Director of Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy. He's author of the book Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. This is Your Call, and today we are talking about the military budget. Just last week, President Obama signed a $633 billion military spending bill. It passed the Senate 98-0. When you factor in homeland security and other costs like health care, for example, for soldiers, you're talking about $1 trillion a year. And on our Facebook page, I posted this great piece by Brad Plummer at the Washington Post. It's full of all of these charts. And he points out that the U.S. spends 20% of the federal budget on the military. And the U.S. spent more on the military than the next 13 nations combined in 2011. So what are your thoughts on this? There's really little to no debate in the media, a little debate in D.C., a fair amount of debate among organizations across the country, but we don't really hear much from them. So what are your thoughts on military spending? What questions do you have about where all of this money is spent? What will it take to have a real debate on this? Well, we're having a debate about Chuck Hagel, the possible new Secretary of Defense. A lot of people say he's going to have to make cuts. So what will it take to have a real debate about these issues? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And where would you cut the military budget? 866-798-8255. You can email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And Bill, you know, we kind of throw around this term military budget because it is so big at a time when we're seeing major cuts. In fact, up and down the state of California today, a number of groups are marching and saying no more budget cuts because we've seen so many. What would you say to people about how to really grasp this? I mean, I had a hard time finding a website that really puts this, you know, there's to make a list, for example, to let you know how this money is being spent.
You mean the Pentagon and related, the Pentagon budget and related activities?
Yes. It's just hard to find it all in one nice place.
Well, I think there's a lot to stick in that one place. That's part of the problem. You know, if you look at the budget overall, the Pentagon's about 20 cents on the dollar. If you look at the discretionary budget, which is everything but things like entitlements, like Social Security, Medicare, and so forth, it's about more like 56 cents on the dollar. So if you think about everything the government does, environmental protection, administration of justice, education, infrastructure, transportation, you name it, you put all those things together, and we spend more on the Pentagon than on all those things combined. So in that sense, you know, that part of our federal budget is very much dominated by Pentagon spending, and that's the part that most people probably think of when they think of government, other than transfer payments like Social Security.
Right. And so every tax dollar, 20 cents, goes to the Pentagon.
Yes, if you look at the big picture. And if you look at just the so-called discretionary programs, it's more than 50 cents on the dollar.
And Chris, what would you add to that, just in terms of, you know, how to wrap our arms around this?
Well, I think one of the stats that you raised was that this idea that, you know, the United States spends more than the next 13 nations combined. I think you ought to also look at those next 13 nations, and after Russia and China, you find that they're pretty much all pretty good friends of ours. And so that if you couple, you know, our nation's spending with those of, say, our closest allies, our NATO allies, you're looking at probably two-thirds of all military spending is spent by us and our best friends. And when you look at the kind of capabilities that we can bring to bear vis-a-vis the other threats that are out there, the actual threats to our national security, I mean, it's what the military refers to as overmatch. The overmatch is astounding. We're so much more capable than everybody else out there. So the problem that we run into is the old sort of mentality of you can't err on the side of caution when it comes to national security. That no matter how much you're spending, there's always an opportunity for greater investment, because we're talking about, you know, preserving our security in an unsecure world. And it's very difficult as people enter into the discussion about military spending to overcome that sort of non-factually based argument, even though the numbers are very compelling about how much more we spend within the context of our own federal budget and how much more we spend in the context of the rest of the world. When you're talking about uncertainty and the abstraction and saying that money is the solution to the problem, there is no limit to how much you can spend.
Well, we have a few listeners who'd like to weigh in on this issue. So let's hear from Millie in Berkeley. Hi, Millie. Welcome to the show.
Hello. I wanted to ask about military bases. I gather outside of war zones, we have a vast number of military bases, and I wonder what they cost and what the excuse for them is.
Well, thank you, Chris. You work on this. At this point, how many bases do we have around the world?
Well, we don't really know, and this is always an interesting discussion to have, because it comes up, and there's this connection between, you know, the number of bases and that type of thing, and what they cost, and I think those are important discussions to have. But I think really the more important discussion to have isn't how many bases we have and where they're located. It's this idea that the United States, and we're unique in the world in this, feels that it's appropriate and in fact necessary to divide the world up into spheres of influence. And the program the Pentagon uses to do this is called the Unified Command Structure. And we quite literally divide the entire globe up into regions, which each of which have their regional commanders, which have forces available to them. And the idea is that no matter where it is in the world, if we feel it's appropriate for us to act or to be there, then we have the ability to do that. That's a staggering commitment of resources, and it's also it speaks volumes about our view of the United States and the world, because, as I said, we're the only nation that slices the globe up into its own little spheres of influence. And so, you know, it's interesting to talk about numbers of bases and that type of thing, but it's this mindset that we have to be able to act unilaterally anywhere in the world that I think drives a lot of our strategic and budgetary decisions.
And according to the Government Accountability Office, construction and infrastructure on U.S. bases around the globe will cost $17 billion last year and could cost even more this year. Does that sound about right to you?
I mean, you know, it's a big number. I think GAO does good work, so I'm inclined to take them at their word. But when you compare it to, you know, other areas of federal spending, I mean, we're going to spend $10 billion, for instance, on this notional ballistic missile defense program next year alone. Throw in the Joint Strike Fighter, and that's another $10 billion. Just those two weapon systems alone, you know, it will spend more on that than we will on our entire global basing structure. So I'm not saying we should discount $17 billion in infrastructure investment around the world. I think it's important. I also think that it's not the dollars so much when you talk about our global presence that's the issue.
And also, according to the GAO, each year the government spends more than $340 billion on goods and services for these various bases. You mentioned this ballistic missile system. Can you just talk more about that briefly?
Well, one of the things that we've been doing in this country since as far back as the 1960s, but certainly since Ronald Reagan's famous Star Wars speech in 1983, is attempting to develop some form of system that will protect the United States from a ballistic missile attack. And the technology still, and we're now probably 150 to $200 billion into it over time. The technology still eludes us, but there's this push, particularly post 9/11, to do something on the issue. And so we continue to spend about $10 billion a year trying to develop technologies related to intercepting ballistic missiles, which to my mind is probably the least rational threat we have to confront out there, and yet we continue to commit vast sums of money towards addressing it.
And who benefits from this? What companies?
Well, all the major ones. I'm sure Lockheed Martin has a piece of it. Boeing certainly does. Raytheon. It's the top 10 list of contractors in this country, all of whom have a little bit of piece of missile defense, just because it's a vast program.
Right. Yeah. And we'll talk about some more of those programs. The F-35. We'll talk about that one after the break. The contracts that are given out today on Your Call. We are talking about the military budget. President Obama signed a $633 billion military spending bill last week. It passed the Senate with little to no debate, 98-0. The U.S. spends more than the next 13 nations combined. Why is this? Why is there hardly any debate? What will it take to really shift the conversation to talk about military spending in this country? It's Your Call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective that you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question you feel needs to be answered, please get in touch by either calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. Or send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. We will discuss coverage of Chuck Hagel's contentious nomination for Secretary of Defense. We'll also talk about coverage of the ongoing foreclosure crisis. And we will discuss political opposition and the crackdown in Bahrain. That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the military budget in the U.S. President Obama signed a $633 billion military spending bill last week, passed the Senate 98-0. When does that ever happen? And when you look at the overall budget, when you factor in Homeland Security, things like health care for veterans, you're talking about $1 trillion a year. The U.S. spends more on the military than the next 13 nations combined. Yet there is very little debate at a time when there's so much debate about things like Social Security and Medicare. So why is this? What will it take to actually start a conversation about this? What would you cut? We actually have full lines, but we'll have one free in just a couple minutes. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Chris Hellman, Senior Research Analyst with the National Priorities Project, where he focuses on military spending, bases, and weapons systems. Bill Hartung is Director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, author of the book Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And now I would like to welcome Christopher Preble to the show. Christopher is Vice President for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Libertarian Cato Institute. He is the author of three books, including The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. Hi, Christopher. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's nice to have you. So we were speaking with Bill and Chris earlier about why there's little to no debate. What will it take to actually start a debate about the $1 trillion a year that the U.S. spends on the military, homeland security, and other related issues? And why is there no debate, in your opinion?
Well, I wouldn't say there's no debate. There's not as much debate as I would have liked. And Chris and Bill and I have been working oftentimes together on this issue for quite a long time. The wars in Iraq, especially, and increasingly Afghanistan, have become quite unpopular. The costs have vastly exceeded any reasonable benefits that we might ever derive. And I think for that reason, above all others, a lot of Americans are asking, what exactly do we get for all these all the money that we spend on the military? On the other hand, the military as an institution and the individual troops, men and women serving in uniform, remain the most respected institution in the country, more respected than organized religion, according to some polls. So people respect the sacrifices that the troops make on our behalf, even when those missions go south through no fault of their own. And I think that, perhaps more than any other, explains why Americans are still there's quite a bit of support, actually, for cutting military spending, more cuts than we've seen up to this point. But I think there's always that concern that if we make cuts without changing the mission, and that is what we ask the troops to do, then we really risk burdening them with an unreasonable set of demands, which is why I think the debate should not just be about what we spend, but why we spend it, and kind of revisiting the purpose of defense, which is to defend the United States and our core vital national security interests, but not be in the business of defending everyone else who can and should defend themselves, being the world's policemen. And I think I heard Chris before the break talking about the way we divide up the world into different combatant commands as though, you know, we truly are responsible for everything everywhere. I think we've got to get out of that mindset.
And also, don't you think that if we had a real, factual, healthy debate in the media about what we're facing, the citizens would be on board with some of this? I mean, when you're talking about massive waste with the F-35, and we'll talk about this later, that's about to reach $1 trillion, when you talk about the fact that not much is being done to deal with military suicides in a trillion-dollar budget, it seems like the citizens would say, wait a minute, what is going on here?
They are. Like I said, the polling data is somewhat encouraging on this. It's discouraging that the people here in Washington haven't quite gotten the message. But when you poll the American people, and it's actually quite bipartisan, there is support for for revisiting what it is that we do and why we do it, and for support for cuts, even on the order, depending on how you word the question, cuts on the order of what we see under sequestration provisions of the of last year's Budget Control Act. So I think that the pressure is on the Pentagon to reform its ways. That that applies to procurement programs like you've noted, and GAO and others have noted, that are horribly overcost and behind schedule and things like that. Especially F-35 is a good example. There also is attention. We need, if nothing else, we need an audit of the Pentagon. Why is it we don't even know what the Pentagon spends, and many people there don't know what it spends and why? That needs to be resolved. I think Congress just needs to play a much larger role in terms of oversight. It has essentially given up on oversight of the Pentagon, and I think that was a real mistake, a real dereliction of duty, to be honest. And I think that hopefully some of the newer members and those who have ascended to leadership positions in some of the relevant committees might be a bit more inclined to ask some hard questions and be responsible stewards of the taxpayers' money. At least that's what I hope. We'll have to see here in the next few months if that transpires.
And we'll get to calls in just a minute. But before that, Bill, do you think that Chuck Hagel, former Republican senator from Nebraska, who might be the next Secretary of Defense, will change any of this? Because he has called the Defense Department budget bloated. He thinks the Pentagon needs to be, quote, pared down. Do you think he might tackle these issues in a real way?
I think he may. I mean, the president obviously has to take leadership. And Hagel historically, it's not like he's been a peacenik, but I think he's recognized that we're at a different place now. So he's talked about the need to match our strategy to what we're spending. He's talked about getting out of Afghanistan as soon as possible, not leaving a big, you know, overhang of people there. He's co-sponsored with Obama when the president was in the Senate, a bill on securing nuclear materials so terrorists can't get them, working towards reductions in nuclear systems. So he's an interesting guy, and I think, you know, could potentially do a good job, but it really depends on, to some degree, on the president. I mean, Leon Panetta, when he came in, people said, oh, he used to be at the OMB under Clinton. He'll be, you know, he can discipline the Pentagon. And he ended up being, you know, one of the most vocal advocates for, you know, staying the course for high Pentagon budget. So I think partly it'll be, you know, does the president give marching orders to a new Secretary of Defense that allows them to make some of those hard choices?
Well, we've got a number of callers on the line, so let's go through a few, and then we'll get responses from our guests. Let's hear from Kelly in Oakland. Hi, Kelly. Welcome to the show.
Morning. Interesting conversation. I just had a couple questions, but I want to put it in a historical context about the black budgets. I think we had Rumsfeld back in 2001 before 9/11 that was going to go before Congress and talk about the missing $2 trillion that never got brought up again.
Right.
Anyway, I wanted to ask the panel about black budgets, and in particular, there's a Huffington Post article about a space program and a secret space fleet that we supposedly are financing. Could anyone comment on that and other budget targets? A lot of top secret.
All right. Well, thank you. I mean, we don't even have an audit of the Pentagon, so chances are we're not going to have much information about these programs, but we will ask in just a couple minutes. We'll take a few more callers. Thanks for calling, Kelly. Let's go next to John in San Francisco. Hi, John.
Yes, good morning, Rose, and thank you very much for taking my call. I wanted to ask about the fact that we're maintaining troops throughout the world, and in some cases it makes no sense whatsoever. Why are we maintaining 85,000 military personnel in Germany? I'd like to note that in March of 2011, Congressman Polis, P-O-L-I-S, from Colorado, introduced an amendment to reduce our military presence in Germany from 85,000 a year to 35,000 a year. He got about 100 votes. It's interesting that the entire California delegation from the Bay Area voted for that, with one exception. The one exception was Nancy Pelosi.
Hmm.
And then, of course, we have the case with Okinawa with 50,000 plus personnel, and the indigenous people there do not even want us there.
Right.
And we're still hanging on.
Yeah, there are protests, especially among women, on a regular basis in Okinawa to shut down that base. Thank you for the question, John. We'll get to it in just a couple minutes. Let's first hear from Marie Louise in Palo Alto. Hi, welcome
to
the show.
Thank you for taking my call. And, yes, I wonder if there's any way that one can find out about how much these companies that are involved in military contracts, what they spend on lobbyists, because they get such enormous amounts of money. And I feel like the idea of letting them also have lobbyists is just obscene, frankly. And I once was at a conference center where one room was getting ready for people that did military contracts. And the material that was printed on the finest of paper, thickest of paper. A lot of money was spent just on that. Mm. Anyway, mostly, though, I'm talking about lobbyists. And I feel like we need to become responsible. This country is in so many ways has acted irresponsibly where it's gone into places on earth and then, frankly, meddled many times. But thank you so much for this program and this idea of making us really pay attention to troops and military bases, I think, is essential if we are going to cut costs. The military bases, I think, is a very difficult thing to bring the number of people down because
right.
people do not want to change their life, frankly. They like living in Germany, having their children in American schools and living the way they do and being able to go back to the United States about four times a year, paid for clearly by the taxpayers.
Well, thank you for the question. Why don't we take that one first? Who would like to talk about this in terms of these weapons companies and their lobbying power? I talk about this website fairly often, Military Industrial Complex, because it lists the contracts. And when you look at January 7th, for example, just one day, the government gave out 35 contracts totaling $523 million to companies like CSC Applied Technologies, Booz Allen Hamilton, Promotion Plus, General Dynamics, Raytheon, Colt Defense, Aviation Company, Turner Construction Company, just so many companies. And these companies got multi-million dollar contracts. So who can talk about that one? Chris, do you want to take that?
Sure, although I would defer to my friend Bill, who has written an excellent book on Lockheed Martin.
Let's go to Bill then.
Sure, leave it up to me. I think one perspective on it is that the defense industry, narrowly defined, has about 1,000 lobbyists, so almost two for every member of Congress. So they've got people to carry water for them. Many of them are ex-members of Congress, ex-congressional staffers, former Pentagon officials, people who know how to work their way around government. And, of course, If you're in government making decisions about, are you going to cut Lockheed Martin a break and you're looking forward to going to work for them two or three years from now, you're probably going to give them a pretty easy time of it. So I think between the lobbying itself and this revolving door between, industry and the government, campaign contributions are small, not by our standards, you or I, but compared to, say, pharmaceutical industry or banking industry, but they know who to give it to. For example, Buck McKeon, California's own Buck McKeon, who's heads the House Armed Services Committee, got $750,000 from Pentagon contractors just in the last two election cycles. And in fact, when his wife ran for the state legislature, she got money from defense contractors. So they know where their bread is buttered, and they spend their money strategically. And of course, a lot of that money comes from us because many of them do very little other than live off of government money.
And as you said, according to Open Secrets, the entire defense industry for last year gave about $100 million, which was less than what they gave in 2009, 2010, and 2011. So it's not that much money when you look at what they get in return.
That's right. It's not very much in terms of what they get. This is Chris, Chris Preble, and not in what they get in return. That's less than the cost of a single F-35 fighter. I mean, many of these companies are publicly traded, and so their expenditures are in the public domain. And equally important, they have to justify their expenses to their shareholders, and it would only make sense for them to do so if they thought they were going to get a considerable payoff. And so you kind of have to put their lobbying expenses in context to what they get in return, which is money from us, the taxpayers, and that, I think, goes a long way to explaining how much they spend and why.
And you're in D.C. Can you name some politicians who have an open door to some of these companies? Like, who gets the most money from these weapons companies?
It tends to flow to the ranking members of the relevant committees in both the chair people and the ranking members of the relevant committees, the Armed Services Committee, the Appropriations Committee, and it goes to both Republicans and Democrats. The companies and the lobbyists like to hedge their bets in the event of a watershed election that changes the deck chairs on the Titanic. So they tend to spread their money around pretty freely.
All right, and we'll put some links up to Open Secrets to find out where these companies are giving their money, and you can find more information about the revolving door, for example, and who's giving the most. And thanks again for that question. And then I wanted to take John's question. What is the justification for maintaining so many troops overseas, specifically, for example, 85,000 in Germany?
I think the answer is... The straightforward answer is that it's a convenient place to jump off to fight wars in the Middle East, so especially Iraq and Afghanistan. The largest, one of the largest overseas hospitals is in Germany and deals with a lot of troops that are wounded very seriously in Iraq or now Afghanistan on their way back to the United States. The problem with that argument is that those kinds of facilities could be maintained through a partnership agreement with the countries in question. You don't need tens of thousands of troops on the ground in a particular place to provide force protection for a military hospital. And I think we've gotten ourselves in the mindset that we have to be in places in large numbers in order to discourage those countries, in some respects, from doing more to defend themselves. That was the point many years ago and remains the object today. Not surprisingly, most Americans, if you poll on this, about a year ago, the New York Times did an unscientific survey, but they asked a long series of kind of options to respondents, which would you cut from the military budget? And the top of the list was reducing troops in Europe. That was the one that most Americans supported. Interestingly, the caller mentioned Jared Polis, a Democrat from Colorado, but Mike Kaufman, a Republican from Colorado, also has pushed very hard for reducing the troop presence in Europe, and Polis and Kaufman have worked together on that legislation. I think given the strong support outside of Washington for that kind of thing, I think it's likely to move forward. I think we're likely to see fewer troops in Germany 5 or 10 years from now than we have today.
And then we had a question from Kelly about black budgets. Do you have any information on those? I mean, I think it's probably hard to find, considering there's no audit of the Pentagon, right?
That's right. I don't have access to that information, and if I did, I couldn't share it over the phone, right? So that's the way they like it. But this is the point. I think the audit of the Pentagon movement to bring some oversight to the Pentagon is at a minimum compel the military services and the leadership there to justify what things are kept from public view. And we might disagree on what should and shouldn't be kept from public view, but they can't credibly claim that nothing is open to scrutiny. And I think that trying to define the parameters of that oversight is an important first step.
All right. Well, thank you for those questions. And we've got just about 8 or so minutes left with Christopher Preble, VP for Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, author of The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe. Bill Hartung, director of the Arms and Security Project at the Center for International Policy, author of Prophets of War, and Chris Hellman with the National Priorities Project. We've got full lines. We'll try to get in as many questions as we can. You might want to email feedback@yourcallradio.org to ensure we get your question. But again, let's go through a few and then we'll get responses. Let's hear from Mark in Oakland. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, good morning. Yeah, my point is, we could say that the World War II helped bring us out of the Depression, helped to drive the economy. And so where's the money for the defense going now? We're not blowing up tanks every day. God help us, we're not doing that. But where's the money? We're not replenishing troop supplies and building more warships that are being destroyed. Where's the money going? just where is it going? That's my question.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a very good basic question. And why don't we just take that one and go through to all of you? Because it's hard to get an answer to that. Bill, where is the money going, the majority of the money? How would you answer that?
Well, part of it is fewer weapons that are far more expensive. You know, the F-35 program over its lifetime could cost $1 trillion and more if you actually try to use the things, you know, the maintaining them. Of course, that's money going way off into the future, 50 years. We're spending about $10 billion a year now. But I think the weapons are more expensive for smaller numbers. The troops, I think rightly so, are better paid, have better benefits. We have a huge operations and maintenance category, which has all manner of sins hidden in there, including sometimes things like, you know, private contractors, like, you know, money for what used to be Blackwater and now has gone through four or five names since then. You know, so I think it's not, you know, weapons are not the biggest part. Part of it is just if you're going to have a global military and you want to be everywhere at every time to fight every battle, it costs a lot of money to have the people to do that, to be able to move them to where you want to use them, to have the base network, and also to have the weapons. So it's sort of, I think, goes back to the idea of, do you feel you have to be able to intervene everywhere in the world?
Well, and then also with the F-35, the most expensive weapon in American history, according to Foreign Policy magazine, hundreds of these will be built before 2019. Why? What's the justification behind this when budgets across the state, across the country are being slashed?
Well, the short answer is, you know, we got to be ready for the Chinese threat, if should it materialize. But in this particular sphere of, you know, stealth aircraft, they're quite a bit behind. And also, it's hard to envision a scenario where the United States and China, two nuclear-armed powers, are going to fight aerial dogfights with fighter planes. So I think there's a whole issue of, you know, it's kind of a whole different mindset of why one would need such things. And part of it, I think, the machine just has momentum, the bureaucracy, the services, the companies. This is what they know how to churn out, and they're churning out more of them.
And a grand total of $1.5 trillion, more than the annual GDP of Spain. Thank you for that fact, Foreign Policy magazine. Christopher, how would you answer that question? Where is this money going?
Well, some of it is going to personnel expenses. In fact, personnel expenses are rising rather quickly. That is both compensation, deferred compensation in terms of retirement benefits for the troops who are currently on active duty. Military health care costs are going up. There's also, of course, been an increase in the cost of what we would consider consumables, especially when you're fighting the war. So food and fuel and things like that, which you use more of when you're fighting a war. It costs more to supply the troops when they're over there as opposed to over here. So those kinds of costs, especially the personnel costs, are likely to be to impose additional pressure on the other parts of the Pentagon budget. That includes research and development of new technologies, the procurement of actual weapon systems and platforms, and a little bit in there for base infrastructure and things like that. I think the focus, especially in the next few years, is going to be on the personnel account. We're likely to have a somewhat smaller military than we have had in the last few years, especially the Army and Marine Corps. But the per Marine costs are rising. And I think there's going to be some attention on how to, as we say, bend the cost curve down.
All right. Well, thank you again for the question. And we've got time for just a few more callers. Let's hear from Zazu in San Francisco. Hi, Zazu. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Good. My question, you were mentioning, like, was $88 million going to Iraq, and there's a lot, billion going to Iraq, there's a lot of billion. But you didn't mention Israel, how many billion going to Israel, and if there's any, why?
How much military money is going to Israel?
Yeah.
Okay.
Is there any budget for it?
Yes. Okay, so there's an article in Business Insider that breaks this down. A U.S. military aid to Israel was $2.7 billion in 2010, $3 billion last year. It's expected to be about $3.07 this year. Does anyone want to talk about U.S. military aid quickly to Israel?
Well, it's the biggest chunk of our foreign assistance, security assistance, other than, of course, Afghanistan, where we're trying to train the military. And it's been that way since the Camp David Accords, at least, you know, going back to the late 70s. So it's viewed partly as a political commitment to Israel. They've developed their own defense industry, partly
applying some of the equipment and funds that we have given them as aid. And I think, you know, there's obviously political questions about the role of Israel in the Middle East, how the United States supports or doesn't support that. And I think our security assistance, it's legitimate for that to be part of the discussion. But I think it's really, in terms of Israel, what's your Middle East policy? How are you going to solve the problems over there? And in that context, you might be able to reduce military aid not only to Israel but to Egypt, maybe stop selling tens of billions of dollars of weapons to Saudi Arabia, just work with allies to try to demilitarize that entire region, I think would be a worthy goal.
All right. Well, thank you for that. And we'll put a link to this piece right on our website after the show. We've got about a minute left. Final thoughts from you, Chris. Where is this debate going? And what can people do to actually bring these issues into the conversation?
It's a good question. And I think one of the things that's intriguing about this is that because of the fiscal climate that we find ourselves in, this emphasis on deficit reduction, we now have an opportunity to bring Pentagon spending into the debate in ways that we haven't been able to do so in recent years, because I think increasingly people recognize, particularly at the local level, that federal budgeting right now is a zero-sum game, and that if you're looking at deficit reduction and you're not going to cut the Pentagon, then you're going to be cutting other federal programs that touch people's lives on a daily basis. So, you know, you asked earlier about whether there's a discussion going on. I think you're seeing increasing discussion at the local level about what the impact of federal priorities are. And I think I don't know how long our window of opportunity to have this discussion will be, but I'm encouraged by the fact that we're actually talking about it at any level at this point.
Well, we talk about this regularly on the show, and we will continue to do so. Thank you all for joining us. Chris Hellman is with National Priorities Project. Bill Hartung is author of Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. And Christopher Preble is author of The Power Problem, How American Military Dominance Makes Us Less Safe, Less Prosperous, and Less Free. Thank you all for joining us and speaking out on these issues.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. On next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of Chuck Hagel's contentious nomination for Secretary of Defense and the ongoing foreclosure crisis. We'll also talk about the ongoing political opposition crackdown in Bahrain. We'll be joined by ProPublica's Paul Keel, Salon's Alex Seitz-Wald, and independent journalist Reese Ehrlich, who's just back from Bahrain. Where did you see the best reporting this week? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.